Today on Against the Grain, film brings to us, with unparalleled rawness, what feels like the intimate experience of war. But how true is that visceral feeling? How do the tension and excitement of war on screen ultimately affect our sympathy toward each other and our humanity? David Thompson, one of the greatest film historians of our time, argues that movies, even those with anti-war intentions, perpetuate war. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Film and modern warfare were born at the same time. 1914 heralded the beginning of World War I and the era of movies. And since their mutual inception, modern war has been ubiquitous in film. Whether propaganda films during World War II, Vietnam War blockbusters like Apocalypse Now, movies depicting U.S. interventions like Black Hawk Down, or more recent films of war and combat made overwhelmingly with special effects. In The Fatal Alliance, A Century of War on Film, one of our most preeminent film historians, David Thompson, draws the conclusion that films have deceived us about the true nature of war, and by doing so have made endless war viable. David, this is asking the obvious, but I'm going to do it anyway. How important has the depiction of war been to film?
Well, war has been a central genre of entertainment. We like to think that film's coverage of war through what we call documentary has been a reminder of how absurd and perilous war is. And, you know, we like to think that we have a tradition of anti-war films. And there's no question that there are films that have been made in that spirit. And as to what purpose they have had or what function they have had, it's much harder to say, because for all the anti-war gestures and films we've made, war goes on and on. And one of the things that I was driven to in coming to do this book was the strange feeling that people who were intellectually absolutely opposed to war and thought it was awful enjoyed war films, and more particularly enjoyed combat films. I think a crucial event that made me want to do this book was a talk with one of my sons, and we sort of were talking about war films, and almost in one voice, we seized upon Black Hawk Down, Ridley Scott's film about American troops in Mogadishu. And we said, we love the film, and absolutely love the film. And I'm speaking personally, not just for him. It's a film that I take a look at regularly, like once a year. And even if it's on television and I find it by chance as I'm flicking through the channels, I will stop and watch 20 or 30 minutes of it, because I know it very well, but there's something about its enactment that I find deeply satisfying. And that is really a shaming realization. And my son and I came to that conclusion straight away, that we loved Black Hawk Down, but hated ourselves for loving it. And I thought that was a very intriguing contradiction. And I had a sort of instinct that it It was not just something that my son and I felt, that it's something that men particularly, but not only men, feel. And it's part of the conundrum we have in believing we're making anti-war films when actually the fantasy project of combat is thrilling and fulfilling. And to that extent, I think this is really the main thrust of the book, that films about war have stimulated the desire for war. And this is a very dark recess in human nature, I think. And, you know, I'm not speaking in the sort of disapproving way simply. I have this feeling myself, and I suspect some at least of your listeners who are probably progressive and totally opposed to war still get some excitement out of it. And that is a dark, strange part of our lives, I think.
And we'll be talking more about this as we go on, but I wanted to ask you, do you think that is because of the medium of film itself, the spectacle? Or do you think that in the telling of war, that particular tellings that we seem most interested in, whether it's in film or some other medium, are going to lend themselves to this sort of arousal and excitement that you're speaking of?
I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the medium. And this affects many genres apart from war films, but it's particularly sharp in films about fighting, I think. The situation of movie going is very often to watch events of high drama or melodrama with great danger, and to be in a situation of warmth, safety, and security, so that you become an interesting kind of voyeur. You're looking at something almost like a connoisseur, a spectator, an onlooker, when if you were confronted with that action in real life, I think you would feel compelled to intervene. Not very usefully, maybe, but you would feel that you have to get into that action, because simply to sit back and watch it is sort of abdicating from complete human responsibility. Now, that condition affects all movies. For instance, for decades, we watched the anticipation of sex in a movie, and we were, in a way, we were peeping Toms, because we didn't have to own up to our existence to the people on screen, but we were getting our kicks from it, and to a degree, quite a big degree, we were getting our sexual education from it. And I think it had a profound effect on the way men and women regard their sexual intercourse as an extension of the fantasy thrill that you get in movies. And as well as sex, a main content of the films was danger, and the feeling that you were rising, hopefully, to a kind of a degree of courage and prowess, accomplishment. You were going to win, and you know, for several decades, combat films, fighting films, adventure films were predicated on this notion that the hero, who was carrying all your hopes, was going to come through. He was going to be successful. He was going to prove that a man can be all that a man wants to be. Over a period of time, many decades, I think that has had a quite devastating effect on how we actually deal with one another. So that's in the nature of film. And I do think that that affected war films very much.
Obviously, the story of war on film has been told has changed since the early 20th century. But I wanted to ask you if that thrill that you're describing that people get from film is innate and was innate from the get-go, or if in a sense the public had to be made that enjoyed war on film.
Well, I don't have a definitive answer to that. And I think it's a situation where the question is far more important than a possible answer. And what I'm trying to do, not just in this book, but in other books I've written, is to ask that question, which is really, how has the intense actuality of film and our feeling that we are seeing life recorded, how has that affected our involvement in life? In other words, how far has our natural status as citizens or fellows, how far has that turned us into voyeurs who believe we can watch without having a full responsibility? I mean, this is a somewhat crass comparison, but I think it's useful. I think that a large reason why so many people are enamored of Donald Trump is that he seems to be a figure from an entertainment. You watch him because of the outrage, because of the nerve and the cheek he has. It's like watching a villain in movies. And another aspect of what we're talking about is that movie villains early on exerted a real attraction. Morally, they may be indefensible. The actions may be ghastly, beyond our pale, but we can't stop watching them. And for instance, if you want a concrete example of that, in The Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins and his director, Jonathan Demme, found an aspect to Hannibal Lecter that was, I'm going to use this word, and I think it's accurate, that was charming. And there's been that potential in villainy and evil on film that it becomes alluring. And that's largely because we're not actually suffering from the evil. We're contemplating it. We are its spectators, and we are to a degree complicit in it. And I think in very subtle ways, in ways that many of us would hate to own up to, it's affected our behavior. And I think that if Donald Trump were to be reelected, say, it would have a lot to do with this function that we don't quite live according to his evident reality, which is appalling, which is gross, an offense to everything we hold dear, because he retains a horrible entertainment value, which is characteristic of evil figures and monster figures in movies altogether.
We will return to the question of the audience and how we as the public respond to films. But I wanted to ask you how the attitude of Hollywood, so the film industry in the United States, shifted in the early 20th century, so in the aftermath of World War I and then following World War II. How were films made about war, and how do you think they were shaped by larger societal forces in those times?
Well, the cultural impact of the First World War, or the Great War, which is what it was called at the time, is an endless subject. And it's not a casual matter, I think, that we have now called the Great War the First World War. Because once you call it the First World War, you are sort of implying that there will be a train of events that we are following almost in a kind of tradition. So we had a Second World War, and as we talk, it's not inconceivable that we might be interrupted by a Third World War, albeit a war that would be sudden and quicker than the First or the Second World Wars managed to be. There is a kind of feeling of a natural suspense now that a Third World War may be coming. We shouldn't forget that very soon after 1914, people identified what was happening as the Great War. And I think that means that there was a realization that whereas there had been relatively small local wars for centuries, they happened far away, they happened beyond the reach of media, so that people wrote about such wars, there were paintings of them. We know a little bit about the Battle of Borodino, say, because Tolstoy wrote about it. But there was nothing like the kind of intense immediacy of a photographic record of the war. It's not that we got a direct record, because most of what we know visually, photographically, about, say, the Crimean War or the American Civil War, which are both poised at that moment where photography really becomes a mass medium. There's a lot of recreation in those photographs, and there's not that much direct, immediate, unmediated recording of the war itself. And in the Great War, there were photographic teams, cinematographic teams, that tried to film the war, but they discovered that it didn't look like war when you photograph the real thing. And I think that filmmakers realized that they needed to go back and recreate the war to make it coherent. And one of the great fallacies in the films that came after the Great War and into the Second World War is that they were very contrived. And it's not that there weren't documentary attempts. There are some very interesting documentaries about the Second World War. They're very partial, because photographing these things was very dangerous, and it was not an obvious way of doing it. The tradition of war films was a recreation, a theatrical restaging of combat, which was derived from many attitudes to combat along the lines I've been talking about, which was that the good side were going to win, that a battle was an organized event, that one army moved left to right, the other army moved right to left, so that on screen it was coherent. Whereas most people who've been in battle report that it was chaos, that while there may have been a plan and there may have been orders, they didn't have too much relationship to what actually happened. So it's very hard to film war in a way that is true to the experience of people who have been fighting it. And the great illusion of our most famous war films is that there is a way of winning a battle, and it has to do with virtue and courage, as well as equipment and superiority of numbers and that kind of thing. And the war films became, in a funny way, an advertisement for war. They didn't always have that intention in mind, but they were an encouragement to young men to sign up, to enlist. And it's a part of that that the war makers, the Department of War, the Office of War, whatever it was called, collaborated with the filmmakers and lent them military equipment and uniforms and helped restage them. It was partly because they wanted an heroic portrait of war to come across. Now, there are exceptions to that, but the great famous adventure war films are all made, I think, in that attitude.
Film historian David Thompson is my guest. We're speaking of The Fatal Alliance, A Century of War on Film. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, as you note in The Fatal Alliance, during World War II, fighting, of course, didn't just take place on battlefields. It wasn't about two armies showing up and fighting, but also in cities. And the U.S. was unscathed in this respect. But I wanted to ask you how that war on civilians made its way into film and the dynamic that then played out with civilians in harm's way versus the bravery of two armies clashing.
Well, I don't think it did make its way quickly or easily into the regular making of films. I think that the people who made films, and I'm talking about the film companies, as well as the sort of governmental structure behind them, I think they wanted the attitude to war to seem positive and to offer fulfillment to the men and success in the conclusion. And what happened at home was not easily digested in that spirit. There are a whole lot of aspects of the Second World War that didn't reach the screen until much later. There was film coverage, for instance, of the relief of some of the concentration camps. There was quite a big British film made at the time as a documentary about what the reality was revealed to be in concentration camps when they were liberated. And the British government looked at the finished film, a film that a lot of film professionals had contributed to. Alfred Hitchcock had a quite important hand in the editing of the material, and they decided not to release the film. And their feeling was that to release the film in 45 or 46, which is what it would have involved, would have endangered the attempt to bring the world back together again, because it would have invoked fury and contempt for the enemy, and was not a useful thing. So that the attitudes of propaganda, the needs of propaganda, were very forceful in that decision. And there are not that many contemporary World War II films in which the impact, the domestic impact of bombing, the damage, the fear, are shown on screen. The films are much more about men in battle, being very brave, being very inspired by comradeship and leadership, and all of those things are real enough. But the audience, which was still largely an audience at home, I don't think they wanted to be reminded of just how dangerous it was out on the streets. So the degree to which civilians became soldiers, not because they wanted to be, but because they had no other choice, they had no other escape, that only really sank in later. And just as we didn't really learn about the reality of concentration camps until well into the 1950s, I would say, when there were beginning to be documentaries. Night and Fog by Alain René is a very good example. Documentaries that just showed what the camps looked like and felt like. And that horror came in gradually. Equally, there was not any kind of thorough film account in newsreels or documentary about what had happened in Japan when the atom bombs were dropped. And even last year, in the much praised Oppenheimer, there's a singular gap in that film, I think, in that it doesn't really give proper attention to what happened on the ground when the bombs were exploded above the ground, and damage of a hitherto unappreciated nature was poured out. And it's not that there was a fierce, detailed control of these events, but they didn't hit the screens until a lot later. Similarly, during the Vietnam War, there weren't really feature films about the war. They came after the war. Films like Platoon and Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter even. But there was television coverage, newsreel coverage, night after night in color. And although it's very hard to measure, I do think that that newsreel coverage played an important part in sickening the American public, particularly, over what was happening and the sense of the failure and futility in the exercise. And everyone in authority learned something from the Vietnam War, so that you do not get the same kind of embedded coverage of the combat now. We don't get a great deal of live footage of what's happening in Ukraine or in Gaza. And you can argue that that's because nobody wants to send camera crews into that cockpit, which clearly is a very bad, unsafe place to be. But I think it's also because we're having great difficulty digesting, coming to terms with the function of these wars that are going on, and which could easily break out into what we would have to call World War III, even if we were dead before we'd finished the phrase.
Well, staying with the Vietnam War, obviously between World War II and the Vietnam War, with the Vietnam War, there was a shift in public attitudes towards war. And also in the 1970s in the U.S., some of the greatest American movies were made when directors and writers with left-wing politics could make more critical films. How do you consider, in hindsight, the films that came out of the Vietnam War and this tension that you've been flagging for us between even film that shows the brutality of war, which was certainly a hallmark of many of the films that came out after the Vietnam War, and yet the kind of spectacular experience of watching the excitement unfold on screen?
Well, I'm not sure that the famous feature films about Vietnam really do get more deeply into the nature of that war. You know, Platoon, Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, they really are talking about that war from the American point of view. And you can argue that in all of those films, there is a feeling of sort of intense regret that we were there. But they don't talk very much or argue very much about why we got to be there. And one of the things that I like very much about the long 16-hour or so TV documentary made by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, The Vietnam War, is that all of a sudden there was a film that said, well, if this is the Vietnam War, we've got to hear from Vietnamese people. There are really no Vietnamese characters beyond figures in the jungle who get shot down in those famous war films. But in the Burns-Novick show, you get lengthy interviews with Vietnamese people who talk about what it felt like to have a foreign army immensely more sophisticated and better equipped than their own army come thousands of miles to liberate their country. And you know, the grace of those characters in the way they talk fairly and honestly and with some sense of forgiveness about what happened is in itself an immense lesson, because what we, at first at least, judged to be a war of liberation that would save the world from this mythical line of collapsing dominoes, to the Vietnamese was a war of invasion and interference. And you get the same thing in Black Hawk Down. Black Hawk Down is a story of American failure, but it doesn't really bother to analyze the stupidity or the arrogance that lay behind the failure and almost guaranteed the failure. And still to this day, we have immense confusion about understanding the political history of wars. And if you go back to the Great War and the way it led to the Second World War, you have to understand that the severity of the terms of the peace treaty that ended the Great War is inseparable from the inevitability of the Second World War. I mean, in a way, we had one war in that 20th century, which you can depict as being the wickedness of Germany. It was infinitely more complicated than that. And I would have to say that our movies, even the best anti-war movies do a pitiful job at describing the political reality behind it. So that if you're talking about the Vietnam War, Errol Morris's The Fog of War, the film where he talks to McNamara, Robert McNamara, the Secretary for War, is a much more useful way of understanding what happened.
Well, you mentioned that one of the failures of the films about war, including the Vietnam War, is their one-sidedness. It's from the perspective of the soldier who is sent overseas. But I wanted to ask you about film and revolution and anti-colonial struggles, the most iconic being a film that you write about, The Battle of Algiers. How do you view that film and films like it that are celebrating a kind of resistance?
Well, I think you have to understand what that film, Battle of Algiers, was like when it opened. It was radical, startling, very cinematic in quite old-fashioned conventional ways. And to some degree, that glow and thrust has worn away now, so that we see it as a period piece almost, and a romanticization of the resistance attempt. The complexity of what happens to loyalties and allegiances and to standards of decency in any war are very complicated. And I don't think film is actually the best or a good medium for dealing with it. Because film sort of almost took over the culture in the 20th century, it became the focal point, so that people who feel they understand what happened in the Vietnam War are referring to a number of films, and they may not have read a single book, let alone a really good searching book, about what happened in that war. We understand, or fail to understand, other parts of the world because film seems so vivid, so urgent, so full of the truth 24 times a second. That's an illusion and a fallacy, because the truth, the real truths, lie deeper down, and they have to do with a lot of talk, a lot of words, a lot of description, rather than the flourish of a great war scene. And you know, those Vietnam films are vivid as can be, and Platoon, Apocalypse Now, are amazing spectacles. But alas, war is much more than spectacle. And film is not good at catching that, I think.
Film historian David Thompson is my guest. We're discussing his book, The Fatal Alliance, A Century of War on Film. So, David, how would you then characterize the war films of the 21st century, which opened with the military debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I would have to say that they only demonstrate that the movies, the screen, may be very spectacular, but what it offers is only a partial, restricted view of what went on. And American culture, I think, has been very much shaped by the notions of American heroism, technical excellence, prowess, and greatness, when there are many countries in the world that don't chant to themselves about how great they are. I don't know what makes a great country. If I think about the country I came from, England, Britain, if someone says to me, what's great about Britain? I would say, well, the countryside is great about Britain. The sort of ironic humor, the underplaying in Britain is a great quality. And I think the sort of rather grudging, inefficient decency that the British try to live by is great. But you know, the greatest thing is that the country, even though it was called Great Britain, doesn't really believe in greatness. I think it's the responsibility of countries to be decent, not great. Because in the end, great is a sort of explosion of fantasy. And I'm afraid to say, as a film historian and as someone who loves film deeply and loves many of the films about war, I don't think the cinema, the screen, has done anything like justice to war.
I wanted to return to the argument you've been making about, and you make in your book, about the effects of our viewing of films and their telling of war on screen and how that affects us as human beings and as people who might take action in the world or not. And you're suggesting that being able to watch war as a excited spectator has this sort of deadening effect on us. And I wanted to ask you if you think that that continues now. I'm thinking about Israel's assault on Gaza and how there has been a kind of anti-war movement that has emerged globally in different places in different ways. And whether you think that anything has shifted there in the outrage that so many people feel from whatever information they are getting, if that deadening effect of the way that we think of war is monolithic or it can be broken?
I think what we're witnessing is a really large shift in the way in which the rest of the world thinks about Israel. Israel, for most of my life, was a hallowed place and idea and ideal. And that had to do with the way we saw it as a proper redemption from the unspeakable horror of the Holocaust. And what is happening now, I think, is that day by day, the Israel of Netanyahu is destroying that illusion, that hope in the minds of the rest of the world. Now, I think that does great damage. Equally, I'd have to say that the wiping away of fantasies, of dream interpretations, has to be a good thing. And the situation in the Middle East has all my life has been vexed beyond belief. And I can only think of how many statesmen have sort of staggered away from that cockpit, throwing up their arms and saying, it's hopeless. We're never going to find a solution. And I think that it's more than possible that some kind of war is going to envelop what we call the Middle East with the western parts of the old Soviet Union. and be a war without end, not just a war, not just a world war, but another concept, a war of world. In other words, a world that is constantly at war. And that is absolutely horrifying prospect. I don't know whether we can draw back from it. What's happening in Gaza can persuade one that nobody has the insight or the courage or the will to draw back from it. Maybe another way of doing things or thinking about things is as valid, which is, when provoked, don't always do the obvious thing. But the idea that inaction might have served a purpose, I find very interesting. But it's a very uncinematic response. And, you know, as we've been talking, the cinema has changed the way we think about combat. It's given it a wonderful, enticing unreality that looks totally like life.
Well, I'd like to end, David Thompson, by asking you about your contention that one of the things that has allowed for the support for war is precisely the screen and the way that cinema, that film, that the movies have changed the way we experience war so that we end up not opposing it. I wonder if you could talk about how that functions in our time and the role of technology in it.
Well, I think you have to mention, which is that in the late 20th century and into this century, filmmaking has been transformed by what in general we can call special effects. And special effects have changed war films in that, whereas once upon a time a movie played the game of dressing actors up as real soldiers and trying to stage the combat as realistically as possible, we are now into a culture where armies are not real people, or even sometimes real soldiers. They are digital effects. And it's very much easier to slaughter digital armies than it is real armies, in that that separation of our watching and feeling is streamlined now. And you know, there's a whole mass of films, very successful films, not films that get a great deal of serious critical commentary because they are regarded as too mainstream, too lowbrow even, but in which individuals and masses of men, such as never existed, are wiped out and nobody feels the pain. It's the old issue. If you're going to hurt someone on screen, you've got to deliver the pain. And the medium of film has reached a point where they're uninterested in the pain. That's because of the technology. And that technology is, it's changing the way films are made, but it's changing the way we think about everything. We're talking about a level and a form of artificial intelligence that mocks the old idea that when you look at a movie, you're looking at an honest version of life. Nowadays, you're looking at people who do not exist being killed. And if they don't exist, then killing them is a lot easier.
David Thompson, thank you so much. It's been an utter pleasure having you on.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you very much.
David Thompson is a film historian. We've been discussing his latest book, The Fatal Alliance, A Century of War on Film. You can find a link to that at againstthegrain.org. He's the author of numerous books about film, including The Biographical Dictionary of Film, and one of my favorites, The Whole Equation. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.